It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here in the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, we'll talk about Wisconsin's voter ID laws. They're in the spotlight as we near the state primary.
But first, the presidential race has arrived in Wisconsin. Candidates Clinton, Cruz, Kasich, Sanders, and Trump have all been stumping in the state in the days leading up to the April 5th presidential primary.
And Wisconsin is the only game in town next week, so political observers from around the country have been watching us closely and eagerly awaiting new polling data.
Harry Enten is a senior political writer and analyst for 538. He joins us weekly to talk about national politics. Harry, welcome back.
Thanks for having me back.
So watching Wisconsin this past week or so, what stuck out to you about the visits and the events you've been seeing?
I think just that Donald Trump is going after Scott Walker. I'm going to myself, what is he doing? Scott Walker has an 80% approval rating among likely Republican primary voters, according to the most recent Marquette poll. I mean, Trump has been known to drop rhetorical bombs all over the place, but some of us thought maybe there was some strategy to what he was doing. But to go after Scott Walker in Wisconsin is like going after the Red Sox in Boston. I just don't get it.
And he has in ways, it sounds like, and maybe Walker, too, from his end of things, in a way made the primary a referendum about Walker's performance in the state, it seems like.
I think that Walker knew exactly what he was doing right. He signaled a week ago that he was probably going to endorse Ted Cruz, and of course he does endorse Ted Cruz. And I think Walker knows this state a lot better than Trump knows it based upon Walker's electoral record here or there. And I think he set a beautiful trap for Trump, and Trump apparently has walked right into it. And the question now in my mind isn't whether Cruz is going to win the state, but by how much.
And we have a little clip of that endorsement you were talking about. Governor Walker did endorse Texas Senator Ted Cruz. We don't have the clip, but we've heard it now. We know what the fallout was. The fallout is that Trump did not take this very lightly, very gently. He's gone pretty aggressive going after the governor, as you said. And do you think that given the latest polls that we're seeing, is there a shot that Donald Trump takes Wisconsin from Ted Cruz?
I mean, of course, it's possible. I wouldn't, you know, polls have margins of errors and who really knows, but the consistent thing that's been going on throughout the primary season is Trump gets to a certain percentage in the polls and then kind of holds, and then election day either matches that percentage or falls a few points short. In all of the states where he's been trailing in the polls, he's lost, and in a number of states where he was leading in the polls, he's actually lost. So if Trump is trailing and all of the recent polls, except for maybe one, have him trailing Ted Cruz, Ted Cruz is going to be the odds-on favorite to win in Wisconsin.
Now, in a town hall meeting in Milwaukee yesterday, hosted by CNN, Anderson Cooper asked Donald Trump if Trump would support the eventual GOP nominee. And this is something that Trump had said, yeah, I am going to do this. There are pledges even that were signed. But here's what Trump had to say.
Do you continue to pledge whoever the Republican nominee is?
No, I don't anymore. Look,
you don't?
No, we'll see who it is.
You won't promise to support the Republican nominee?
And he was essentially saying the same thing. Let me just tell you, he doesn't have to support me. I have tremendous support right now from the people.
Well, Trump has gone backseas on that. It sounds like Cruz has gone backseas, too. What do you make of that, Harry?
I think that this was a mistake by the Republican Party. They sort of, they were trying to make sure that Trump didn't run as an independent or a third-party candidate. So they said, okay, sign the pledge. But in reality, all they did was recognize him as being a legitimate candidate, and Trump, being the businessman that he is, signed it and said, I'm going to abide by it as long as they hold up their end of the bargain. But all Trump has to say, and all he did have to say, was, look, they're no longer abiding by it, so neither am I. Adios, amigos, goodbye. And he's basically trying to delegitimize if someone else besides him becomes the nominee, and whether or not he tries to run somehow as a third-party candidate or gets his voters to stay home in November because he's upset that he didn't get the nomination. That's all he's doing right there.
Well, obviously this was not a binding agreement, this pledge that everybody signed. Does this come as a surprise at all that this is what the candidates are saying today?
I mean, I don't think it's really much of a surprise that Donald Trump says something one day and then the next day says something else. I mean, that's pretty typical of his campaign. I think the other Republicans probably were silly in believing that Trump might be able, would hold to his word. But I think, in fact, Trump may have made an error insofar as now he's given an excuse to the other candidates to back away from the word. And there have been a whole lot of murmurings within the Republican base, or certainly the conservative parts of it, that they don't want Trump as the nominee. And they couldn't understand why candidates like Cruz were saying, I'm going to back the Republican nominee. This gives him an excuse to say, you know what, if it's Trump and he says he's not going to back the nominee, well, I'm not going to either if it's Trump.
Looking now not at Trump or Cruz, let's turn to Ohio Governor John Kasich. He's also been in Wisconsin last week. I think you said, what is he doing there? He should be in New York, but he has been here, still saying he's not going to win, but he's hoping to win over delegates who will switch at a convention. What do you think about that strategy and what he's been saying on the ground in Wisconsin?
I mean, it could work in the sense that, you know, if you look at the polling data, he's very competitive within the Madison television market. He could come away with some delegates from the 2nd Congressional District if he wins there, and the polls indicate he has a decent shot of doing that. So that's three delegates. Three delegates is nothing to sneeze at, but three delegates out of 42 is a pretty small margin. But, you know, to me, if you look at the polling in New York and you look at the polling in Pennsylvania, Kasich runs either second or first in a number of congressional districts there, and statewide in Pennsylvania, where he was only down by 3 points in the most recent poll out of Pennsylvania. So to me, I mean, I get it. I guess he wants to keep his name in the news, but the polls clearly indicate that this is a two-man race, at least statewide, between Trump and Cruz. So if I were Kasich, I'd train my fire onto someplace else, that being New York or Pennsylvania at this point.
Now, we talked yesterday on the show and a little bit now about Governor Walker endorsing Ted Cruz. The Journal Sentinel, the newspaper out of Milwaukee, they endorsed John Kasich. Does that kind of endorsement, do you think, have any sway over voters?
John Kasich has been endorsed by any number of newspapers. If a newspaper endorsement made nominees, John Kasich would be running away with the nomination right now and laughing his way to Cleveland. Unfortunately for him, newspaper endorsements really don't tend to mean that much. There may be a few examples where they do, where they make surprising endorsements. But in this particular case, I don't think it's particularly surprising at all when a newspaper endorses John Kasich, because Kasich, with his sort of nice guy image that he's been projecting on the scale, really does seem to appeal to a lot of newspaper editorial boards.
What about endorsements in general? Do you think that they're convincing anybody who's on the fence?
I mean, they can. I think what they really can do, though, in this particular case is, look, if you're supporting Donald Trump, you're not going to change your mind because Scott Walker said, I'm not going with Donald Trump. But what it can do is be a signal to some people who were thinking, maybe I want to back John Kasich, and Walker says, no, Cruz is our guy. Okay, I'm going to go with Cruz, and it helps consolidate that never Trump vote. And I think that that's some possibility. I wouldn't be surprised if Cruz did a little better in the on election day than he did in the polls. As you see a consolidation, we saw the same thing happening in Utah, where Cruz did significantly better in the Utah caucus than the pre-election polls had indicated, in part, I would believe, because he got endorsed by Mitt Romney and the governor, Gary Herbert, out there, who are very popular.
We're talking with 538's Harry Enten right now, talking national politics in the lead up to the Wisconsin primary. And getting to the Democrats now, you mentioned caucuses. Now, caucuses, Bernie Sanders doing great with caucuses around the country, and he's running out of them. He's got primaries, and he hasn't been faring as well there. How is that playing out?
Well, that's basically the problem, right? I mean, Bernie Sanders does very well out in the West, where a lot of those caucuses are held. But even controlling for that fact that he was supposed to do well out there, he does even better in caucuses, which tend to get very liberal voters out there, people who are really, really enthusiastic. And Bernie Sanders supporters, if nothing else, are really enthusiastic. If you look forward in the calendar, you say, okay, Bernie can win a couple of states, one of them being Wisconsin. But even there, his lead in the polls is not anywhere near where we would project it need be if he is going to catch Hillary Clinton in the pledged delegate count. And keep in mind, despite Bernie doing very well this past weekend and the weekend before that, he still is about 230 pledged delegates behind. And if he wins Wisconsin by the amount that the polls in Wisconsin are indicating, he would be able to cut into that, but not by very much, and certainly not by anywhere near the amount that he would need to in order to be competitive to win the nomination down the road.
So you've read, I'm sure, your colleague Nate Silver's scenario there in which Sanders does get enough delegates to win the nomination. Nate Silver said he was able to squeak out a scenario in which that is the outcome, but that it's really pretty unlikely. But I guess it is possible.
I mean, of course it's possible. Who knows what happens? And Nate showed me that sheet beforehand, and we both kind of went at it, and we went, wow, this is really, really tough. I mean, anything is possible in politics. I never dismiss anything, especially a year in which the Republican front runner is a guy who had a cameo on Home Alone 2. But I just don't see it unless there's some radical change. Now, if Bernie Sanders goes into Wisconsin and wins it by 20 points, then maybe we'll have a conversation. But if he only wins it by 5, which is where the Marquette poll had it about, that's far less telling that he's going to be able to really mount a campaign to really make this competitive to the end.
Now, looking at Wisconsin in general, its primary is coming up next Tuesday, the only primary on that day. I've been seeing articles like Wisconsin is the new New Hampshire. Do you believe that? Is it?
I mean, look, every delegate matters on the Republican side right now. I mean, there was a little thing in Alaska where Marco Rubio was able to corral five delegates that he had, but then the party was going to release because he wrote a note to them. And that, to me, was important that he was able to keep those five delegates. So any amount of delegates matter. But, you know, each state is one state at a time. I could easily imagine Ted Cruz winning Wisconsin, and then 2 weeks later, Donald Trump winning in New York, and then the media narrative shifts again. At the end of the day, we really have to take this primary one day at a time, one delegate at a time, and see where we are after June 7th.
So still some debates on the horizon. There was a little back and forth about whether Hillary Clinton would agree to another debate coming up with Bernie Sanders. She did agree to do that. Now, how much do you think debates matter as we head into not the home stretch, but we get deeper into it?
I think they matter less and less in the sense that we really have the demographic lines kind of drawn. You know, if you remember in 2008, we had all of those moments, you know, Barack Obama, Jeremiah Wright, shame on you, Barack Obama, all this stuff with Hillary Clinton and Obama. And at the end of the day, it was just the demographics told the story. And that, to me, is what's probably going to happen. Now, that doesn't mean a debate couldn't have an impact this late in the cycle. Who really knows, you know, if Hillary Clinton all of a sudden decided to mimic Donald Trump on abortion, then maybe. But otherwise, to me, it's entertaining, it's fun, it can move some votes, but not the amount of votes that need to be moved in order to really make an impact, at least on the Democratic side.
Now, we started out with the GOP, Harry, and as we wrap up, we talked about how Donald Trump, I think Ted Cruz, backing out on that pledge to support the eventual nominee. So what kind of scenarios are unspooling in your mind as we have that new information?
I mean, to me, it's just this. The convention in Cleveland is going to be ugly either way you cut it. It will be fun politics, but I also think it could be dangerous with the whole talk of riots and all of that stuff. But this is a primary that's going to go all the way down to the final day, June 7th, and it may even go into overtime as we head to the convention in Cleveland.
Do you think that Donald Trump has the time to mount a third-party run at this point?
I think it's very difficult for either side to mount a third-party run. There are going to be threats, but I think the real sort of fear for either candidate would be that the other candidate's supporters decide to stay home on Election Day in November if they're that upset that the other person became the nominee.
Harry, thanks a lot. We'll talk to you next week.
Thank you.
Harry Enten is a senior political writer and analyst for 538. He joins us every week to talk about national politics.
Wisconsin's primary is only about a week away, and it's the first time the state's voter ID laws will go into effect during a really major, possibly larger turnout election. Those laws have been the point of heated debate, even got some criticism from presidential candidate Bernie Sanders speaking in Appleton yesterday.
What we have seen is governors in Wisconsin and around this country making it harder for people to participate in the political process. That is wrong.
According to a ProPublica report from last week, Wisconsin hasn't adequately funded voter outreach programs to inform the public about voter ID laws. As a result, there are concerns that voters won't know what they need to bring to the polls and may not be able to vote.
Here to tell us more about how voter ID laws have played out in other states, how it might affect voting in Wisconsin, is Brenton Mock. He's a staff writer at City Lab, a former reporting fellow on voting rights for Color Lines and The Nation magazine. Brenton, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Yeah, thanks for having me on.
Well, this argument that there hasn't been enough education funding, outreach funding for Wisconsin's voter ID law, is this a complaint you've seen covering this issue in other states?
Yes, absolutely. And it normally comes up during litigation over voter ID laws. Pennsylvania passed a voter ID law around the same time that Wisconsin did, which was taken to court. And, you know, that voter ID law was eventually overturned by the courts. And one of the main things that that brought that overturning along was the fact that the state had not been investing enough money or time in adequately educating and promoting the voter ID law when it was in place. And what's at stake with that is that if the people don't know what is required of the voter ID law, then that could lead to a lot of confusion when it comes time to vote.
And I've seen some criticism saying that if you don't fund this education outreach well enough, it's a sign that the law was passed in bad faith, that the intention is to keep people from voting. Is that something you buy?
I think it doesn't matter if that's what the intention is. I think if the effect is that people are disenfranchised, either because they're confused about what ID is needed, or because they don't have the ID that is needed to vote. And for the many people who simply just can't get ID, a driver's license or an ID, then that's bad enough. As for whether certain people intended to kind of suppress the vote, you know, I think that there's been plenty of instances of government officials, both in Wisconsin and outside of Wisconsin, who've mentioned how voter ID laws can throw an advantage to their party or to their race. And so, you know, I'm sure that there are some people who don't have the purest of intentions with this.
On the other hand, voter ID hasn't been a secret here in Wisconsin. We've had people argue over time. This has been a long time coming. People have heard of it. It's on the voter to figure out what they need to do to be able to vote and make sure they're prepared to do that. What do you think?
Yeah, I mean, it's easy to pass the burden or put the personal responsibility excuse on citizens when you have a system of that's failing. And if you're not educating the people about a law that they have to comply with in order for them to participate in democracy, then, I mean, it's really, you know, that's really just bad on the state. You know, I think it may speak more to the state really not understanding, you know, how these kinds of laws would really impact people who don't have ID or who don't have the means to get ID, or even those who are just simply burdened by trying to get the ID necessary to vote. And if we have an unsympathetic state legislature or state system that just, you know, doesn't care about its own residents participating in democracy, then that, it just does not look very well on the state.
Talking to Brenton Mock, staff writer at CityLab, about voter ID as we approach the big primary next week. Voter ID has been in place, in effect, for a couple of Wisconsin elections after a bunch of lawsuits. This will be the first high turnout one. So we're looking at some recent reporting about voter education and outreach on that issue. Brenton, as other parts of the country have put voter ID laws into place, do you see voter turnout going down? Do you see disenfranchisement?
Well, we already know empirically that there's been less voter turnout in the Democratic primaries in this year's elections. The 2014 midterm elections, which was one of the first years where a lot of the voter ID laws were in place, that had one of the lowest voter turnouts in general in decades. And so we do see the impacts of this. We saw it in Arizona, quite frankly, which probably had the most disastrous primary election of all of the states just last week. And there you had lines of, you know, people standing in lines for 4 to 5 hours, some of them past midnight. And when asked why, you know, people had to stand in line so long, some of them said it had to do with confusion around Arizona's voter ID laws and also other laws about proof of citizenship and other issues. So, I mean, we're definitely seeing the impact. We also saw it in North Carolina, you know, where organizations reported, you know, thousands of people not being able to vote or being discouraged from voting because they were confused about that state's voter ID law or just did not have the ID to comply with it.
And do you see particular demographic groups especially impacted by voter ID laws?
Absolutely. I mean, African-Americans and Latino-Americans, these are the two demographics that are undoubtedly the most likely not to have the kind of ID needed to vote. And there have been plenty of studies to that both saw this coming years before the voter ID laws went into place, and then also have shown this even with the elections that we have had. You also have a lot of women who have not been able to vote, maybe because their names did not match the names on the voting list didn't match the names on their driver's licenses because of marriage status, addresses that have changed because people have moved. You know, we just had this big foreclosure crisis. So that has thrown a lot of people's housing status in disarray. And then you college students. You always have college students, even before the voter ID laws. They always have problems on election day due to residency requirements. Some people try to vote in a place where they go to school, but maybe they're actually registered to vote where they live with their parents in another city or state. In Wisconsin, there's some kind of dubious understandings about how a college ID can be used in Wisconsin. Apparently, you can use a state college ID to vote, but you also have to provide a separate document that proves that you're enrolled in that college when you vote. And I'm not sure that a lot of college students just walk around with that kind of documentation on them.
We'll leave it there for now. Brenton, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Yeah, thanks for having me on.
That's Brenton Mock, staff writer at CityLab, former reporting fellow on voting rights for Color Lines and The Nation magazine. Talk to us about voter ID laws in next week's primary.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Ricker.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Next Tuesday is Wisconsin's spring primary, when voters statewide will decide who gets the state's delegates in the race for president and who will be the next justice on the state Supreme Court, as well as a number of other local elections.
The Marquette University Law School poll has been tracking the statewide races in Wisconsin, along with Governor Walker's approval rating and the upcoming Senate race in November. The new results released this afternoon show Ted Cruz ahead in the Republican primary and Bernie Sanders leading among Democrats.
Charles Franklin joins us to talk about these and other results in today's poll. He's the director of the Marquette University Law School poll, professor of law and public policy at Marquette. Charles, welcome back to the show.
Good to be back.
Hey, before we crack into the numbers, Charles, Wisconsin primaries, I bet you're getting a lot more attention from the national press than we usually would for similar primaries here.
Yeah, you know, we rolled the dice by having the primary this late in the season that everything would be over with, but we won that bet in both primaries, so we're getting tremendous attention here today and going forward to Tuesday. Sometimes having a late primary is actually a pretty good plan.
Well, let's look at the kind of marquee results that I think a lot of people are watching for the presidential primary. The Republican side, lay out what you found.
Yeah, we've seen a good bit of movement here since February, when Donald Trump led by 30% to Ted Cruz at 19%. We now see Cruz ahead by 40 points to Trump 30, Kasich at 21, and 8% undecided. That's among likely Republican primary voters, and has about a 5.8 point margin of error. So it's a lead, but it's not an enormous lead. It shows a real move from Cruz, though, from 19 a month ago to more than double that to get to 40.
Yeah, and when you look at a lot of other states, there's been this, I don't know if they called it never Trump effort or kind of an anyone but Trump effort by Republicans in the establishment that doesn't seem to have moved the needle much. Is it is that kind of effort having an effect, do you think, here in Wisconsin?
I'm not sure that that alone is having much of an effect in this sense, that Trump in Wisconsin has polled behind where he polled nationally in some of the neighboring states. So we've had him pretty consistently in the 20s, 30% a month ago, but now 30% again now. That at a time when he was polling significantly better than that in national and other state polls. So I'm not sure that Trump was especially strong here in the state to begin with. But what we have seen in the last 2 weeks is Republican elected officials, talk radio, coalescing around Ted Cruz, a decision that they took a lot of time getting to, but is now not unanimous, but a pretty strong set of endorsers of Cruz, including Governor Walker on Tuesday.
You broke this down by demographics, by region. Anything on the Republican presidential side strike you as particularly worthy of note?
Well, I think the interesting part is that Ted Cruz wins the Milwaukee city and county area, and also wins the Milwaukee suburbs, and by pretty substantial margins. That's where Trump has been weakest in his polling earlier. Trump wins the Northwest, sort of Wausau up north and over to the Minnesota border, but he only wins it by a single point over Cruz now. That's an area Trump was doing considerably better in, and where Cruz has made some real headway. And then finally, John Kasich is leading by a small amount in the Madison media market, which is a several counties around Dane County as well as Dane. That makes it look like Kasich might have a chance to pick up delegates in the by winning the second congressional district there. So Cruz strong in the southeast, Trump strong in the northwest, but with Cruz catching him there, and then Kasich showing some strength in the Madison area.
Talking to Charles Franklin about the much-anticipated Marquette Law School poll out earlier this afternoon. Let's move to the Democratic side. Charles, Bernie Sanders, a lead, not a huge lead, but a lead on the Democratic side.
That's right. He's slightly expanding his edge. Clinton was ahead by 2 in January, Sanders just by 1 in February, and now Sanders by 4 points, 49 to 45, with 6% undecided. Again, among likely Democratic primary voters here. That's inside the margin of error as well, and you could easily call it a toss-up. But it shows the modest Sanders edge that we saw slowly developing over the course of the January and February.
Interesting breakdown there by age group. How did that shake out?
By age group, we see an enormous strength for Sanders among young voters. It's so large, it borders on the unbelievable. Sanders is taking 83% of 18 to 29-year-olds, Clinton just 13%. I would distrust that number, except that we've been seeing something very similar to it in exit polls. Sometimes it's not quite that large for Sanders, but it often does get there with this youngest age group. But then Sanders' support steadily declines as you go up in age. 30 to 44 is its 59, so he's still winning those. But over 45 to 59 is down to 43, and over 60 down to 31. Meanwhile, Clinton is winning 63% of those over 60. So this age gradient is very powerful, and it means that Clinton does well among those over 45. Sanders does well or very well among those under 45. The important question with age is whether young people will really turn out to vote. And I think Bernie Sanders coming back to Madison for a second time is a good example of the campaign making every effort to make sure that those voters who are young voters who are so supportive of him actually do turn out to vote.
We'll dig deeper into those presidential numbers, maybe with our callers at 800-642-1234. Want to get into some issues here in the state, most importantly, that state Supreme Court race. Charles, how is that moving?
There we're seeing a very tight race. It was essentially tied a month ago. It's still very close. Bradley at 41, Kloppenburg at 36. A 5-point difference, but a whopping 18% undecided about that race. So that 18%, depending on how it breaks, could make a big difference, or it could decide to stay home. We will have to wait to Tuesday to see. This is also a race that's closely tied to which presidential primary people are voting in. Bradley gets over 60% of the vote from Republican presidential voters, and Kloppenburg over 60% among Democratic primary voters. That means turnout in the Republican and the Democratic races for president and the size of that turnout could be an important factor. Right now in our data, people tell us that 54% of them will vote in the Republican primary, 46 will vote in the Democratic primary. So again, that's, of course, subject to change.
One interesting thing that didn't happen between those two polls was that blow up over Rebecca Bradley's writings back in college, the column she wrote. She, when this came out, rebuked herself, her younger self, in effect, for writing what a lot of people described as hateful remarks. Didn't seem to hurt her in the polls at all.
We do not see a decline in her favorability ratings, and we see a little bit of an increase, but not a lot, in how well-known she is. The answer is both she and Kloppenburg are pretty little-known at this point, despite it being this late in the campaign. I think what we don't know, and we did not measure, is how aware people are of these issues in the campaign and issues that each side is using to argue against the other side.
One weird thing in this race, I imagine this would be a very different Supreme Court race if it were the only statewide race as opposed to being on the ticket with both parties having contested primaries.
It certainly lives in the shadow of the overwhelming presidential race. There's no question about that. It's also not unusual for judicial elections here in Wisconsin or anywhere to be low salience affairs, even though the issues are very important and the policies are very important. Virtually every state has relatively less interest in the Supreme Court races. If they stand alone, they tend to be lower turnout races. And the level of information is somewhat limited in part because of the way judicial candidates are reluctant to talk about issues that might come before the court. And so instead you talk about things that are related but don't go directly to what you would do as a judge.
We're talking about the latest Marquette University Law School poll with survey director Charles Franklin.
And we're taking your calls at 800-642-1234. What do you think about these new poll results? Who do you think will win the presidential nomination in Wisconsin? At least will win that primary coming up next week. Who would you like to see win the state Supreme Court race and why? And what do you think about the notable change in the Wisconsin Senate race results? We'll get to those. You can call in now at 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We're continuing our conversation now with Charles Franklin about the Marquette University Law School poll, which was just released this afternoon.
We're taking your calls at 800-642-1234. Cruz ahead on the Republican side by a decent margin over Trump. Sanders ahead, smaller margin over Clinton. What do you make of those results? Are you planning to vote in the primary? Are you going to vote in the other party's primary? You're going to cross over. I'll ask Charles Franklin about that in a minute. And what about that Senate race still further off? Russ Feingold with a lead. We'll talk about that in a moment, but smaller than it used to be. 800-642-1234 is the number to call. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page. Charles, let's hit that Senate race now. No voting action on this one on Tuesday, but this is one you've been tracking. We'll keep tracking. What's the latest?
Well, we've tracked it for over a year, and Feingold has maintained a 11 or 10-point lead over Senator Johnson. But in this one, we see some tightening of that race. Now Feingold at 47, Johnson at 42, a 5-point margin, cutting what had been a very stable race down to about half the margin that it had been. I don't think that's terribly surprising as voters come to focus on politics. Through the presidential races, we're seeing some voters coming home to their candidates who are structuring perceptions of Feingold and Johnson a little more. It's probably also partly due to the Supreme Court vacancy, which has certainly produced more conversation about the Senate and its role and may have brought voters to focus a little bit more on that race. If we move to likely voters, it's even a little tighter, a 3-point race, 48 to 45. So this is a race that I think has been waiting for attention. Once we get past the presidential race, it'll be one of the more interesting games in town going ahead to November.
And that Supreme Court issue you mentioned, that's something Democrats around the country in tight races are trying to sort of beat up on Republicans over, at least from this poll. If that's working at all, it's not moving the needle much.
Well, what we saw in this poll, as well as the last one, is that the public is pretty sharply divided on the filling the vacancy on the Supreme Court. But what's striking is that Russ Feingold, who argues for filling it, if you look at his supporters, they overwhelmingly favor filling it. But Ron Johnson, who opposes taking action, you look at his supporters, they overwhelmingly oppose taking action. So in that sense, both candidates are representing the views of their supporters, but it is their views divide, and so it's very unlikely to see any change, I think, in the perspective of either candidate.
Let's go to our callers now at 800-642-1234. Carol is on the line near Hayward. Carol, hi.
Hi. I was just curious, when they say they call to ask people who they're voting for, are they do they know right off the bat that they are calling Republicans and asking, you know, which Republican they're going to vote for? Or are they calling people not knowing? Because I'm just curious how many people are crossing over, because I know about 8 people that normally vote Democrat that are crossing over and voting for Trump instead. So have they taken that into account?
Carol, thanks for the call.
Thank you. Thank you. We ask people which primary they're going to vote in, so we don't know ahead of time. We simply ask people. But in this poll, we're only finding a modest amount of crossover voting. Among independents, about 60% are going to the Republican primary, about 40% to the Democratic primary, but well over 80% of Republicans are staying in the Republican race, Democrats are staying in the Democratic race. Total, it looks like maybe we would see as much as 10% in crossover votes.
Thanks for that call. So in the course of the interview, you ask which primary you're voting in, but you also ask people to self-identify as Democrat, Republican, or independent. Is that right?
That's exactly right.
Is there a history of much crossover voting? Is that more common maybe when one side has a more competitive race than the other?
I think that's exactly the key to it. If both races are very competitive, as they are here now, you have to give up something to leave your own party behind in order to cross over to make some mischief on the other side, if that's what you're actually doing. You might be drawn out of sincere support for the other side, too, of course. Let's not completely dismiss that. But in recent elections here where that was a possibility, the amount of crossover has been modest or moderate. And it's a sort of thing that people like to speculate a lot about, but really most voters seem to not be drawn to getting into the other party's affairs and tend to stay in their own party.
Talking to Charles Franklin about the latest Marquette Law School survey, looking at the results in the presidential race, last big survey before the actual voting happens on Tuesday. Wanted to ask about another thing. You asked who people will vote for in the nomination. You also asked people from both parties or voting on both sides who they think is going to win the nomination. What kind of things did you find on both sides?
And here we find that even though Sanders is slightly ahead and Cruz is slightly ahead, a majority of Republicans think Trump will win the nomination eventually, and a majority of Democrats think Clinton will win. It's about 65% for Trump, and about 77% of Democrats think Clinton will win. You know, this is the difference between who you're rooting for and who you really think is going to ultimately win.
And you also asked who people are rooting against, in effect. You tracked who had very unsatisfactory ratings among voters. Yeah, what were people telling you there?
Yeah, the question was, how comfortable or uncomfortable would you be with each of these candidates as the president? And if we look just at the percent that say very uncomfortable with them in the White House, across all voters, Kasich does best with just 10% very uncomfortable. Cruz and Sanders are about the same. Cruz at 37% very uncomfortable. Sanders at 36%. And then we get up a little bit higher. Hillary Clinton, 47% say they would be very uncomfortable with her in the White House. 55% say that of Donald Trump. So it's interesting that the two candidates that voters expect to win the nominations of their parties are actually the two that provoke these highest levels of discomfort. However, a lot of that is driven across parties. So, for example, 82% of Republicans say they would be very uncomfortable with Clinton, but only 8% say that of her from within the Democratic Party. So within party, there's a lot more comfort with your party's candidate, a lot of discomfort with the other party. And in Donald Trump's case, 23% of Republicans say they would be very uncomfortable with him. In contrast, only 17% of Democrats say the same of John Kasich. there's quite a contrast there between the feelings Kasich produces across the party spectrum and those that Trump produces.
And that takes us to a point I wanted to end on, the head-to-head comparisons. And there, Kasich, it looks like, does the best among Republicans when run against Sanders or Clinton. Sanders does best among the Democrats when run against any of the three Republicans.
It's a fascinating thing that we've seen really since January in every one of our polls, that the two candidates who voters tell us they don't really expect to be able to win the nomination, nevertheless, each seem to be the stronger candidate in head-to-head matchups going into the fall. It's a paradox of this year's elections that electability does not seem to be the key issue for either party.
We'll leave it there for now, Charles. Thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
That's Charles Franklin, professor of law and public policy at Marquette University and director of the Marquette Law School Poll. He's also co-founder of Pollster.com and founder of PollsandVotes.com. He was with us to talk about the latest Marquette University Law School Poll, which is just released this afternoon. Hey, it's the theme from Jeopardy, famous game show. The show first aired on this day in 1964 with host Art Fleming. Now, the original version of the show aired into the mid-1970s, saw a brief revival a few years later.
That's right. The modern daily syndicated version with Alex Trebek debuted in 1984. It kicked off its 32nd season this fall.
So a long-running show, and with good reason. So Jeopardy, pretty much my favorite game show of all time. I don't watch it much anymore. I think it's probably on during our show. Don't turn on your TV to find out. Keep listening to us. But it's one of my favorites.
I like that one, too, and Wheel of Fortune, because they always seem to be on in the afternoon whenever I had to watch TV in the afternoon. But you know what? I think I'm going to do what you did. I'm going to vote for Jeopardy.
Jeopardy. And here's, so for a while, you remember Who Wants to Be a Millionaire, right? That was a phenomenon for a while. I hated it. Because they'd have like one trivia question every 5 minutes.
Right, it was too drawn out. But Jeopardy, you could go boom, boom, boom through the answers. You knew some of the answers yourself. It made you feel kind of smart.
It had a lot of questions. Who Wants to Be a Millionaire is all about the human drama and getting to know the person. I didn't care about Jeopardy. Did it right. You learned you had about 10 seconds of personal information about each of the contestants.
And what kind of loser needs a lifeline? You should know this information you should not be on the
show. Or don't know it and ask it in the form of a question.
Right.
All game shows should be so good. Well, we'll keep listening. By the way, the theme song's available in a 10-hour loop on YouTube for some reason. This is Central Time.